Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, guests, concepts, thoughts. Help you lead a more positively minded life. And today is an interesting day. We're going to be talking about you fighting your fears of success, dealing with your fears of success. I quote, whether in the boardroom or courtroom, whether pitching a sale or auditioning for a role, many driven, talented people grapple with the same problem. When the heat is on, they choke. As a result, they never fulfill their potential or achieve the success they deserve. Well, one sports psychologist, Dr. Don Green, who is has quite a bit of experience dealing with fear. We're going to learn about his background and how that deal with fear. But he's written a book called Fighting Your Fear and Win. Fight Your Fear and Win. Seven skills well laid out for performing your best under pressure at work, in sports, and on stage. Interesting stuff. Don Green is from the other side. He's an ex-Green Beret. He's a renowned, he was an Army Ranger. He worked with the military. He was even trained to be in the San Diego police SWAT team in counterterrorism. So, you know, I mean, he was in that, the middle of that way of dealing with things, which is face your fear. But Don writes an interesting book. One would imagine, coming from that perspective, it's going to be all behaviorist, you know? Somebody's afraid of the water, throw them in the water, tie a rope around their waist. That's what my family would have done, right? And then just drag them by the boat. Eventually, he'll swim. Now, Don's got some things to offer. Don, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you very much.
It's nice to have you here.
Nice being here.
Let's talk about fear itself. Let's talk about what is fear, or what are these fears that you deal with when you're dealing with performing under pressure and trying to deal with?
Well, when you're performing under pressure, you're dealing with several fears, possibly the fear of failure, of not doing well, obviously, but also the fear of success, of what happens if I really do well. There are negative effects, and with a lot of the performers, athletes, business people that I work with, underneath it all, we see that there's a fear of success, that they haven't really thought out in their mind what would happen. So the fear of changing jobs, of taking a new position, of dealing with things that they're not sure they can handle, presents them with fear of success. If they see enough of the negative effects of it, they'll find ways to prevent that from happening, to sabotage their performance, and not have the success that they're capable of because of a fear of success.
You look around you. You find big fish in small ponds, you know, and you say, wonder what stopped that person from being a big fish in a big pond. You know, wonder why that never got off the ground. I wonder why the ABD, all but doctorate, and they're getting their dissertation. You know, why is that person at the level that they stayed and never gone beyond that level? These are questions that people ask themselves, and you may not necessarily feel fear, but you recognize from the outside this person must be frightened.
Well, you can recognize from the outside that the person is frightened because they're doing nothing. What fear does is restricts people. It prevents them from doing things, from accomplishing things. What they need to do is to act, to move, to get past it, because the fear will shut people down. It will immobilize and prevent them from doing their dissertation or prevent them from attaining that next position. The fear will restrict. Whatever the source of the fear, it will prevent them from achieving what they're capable of.
Don is not a behaviorist, as you might think. We're going to talk a lot about the psychology of this and how it relates to it. But, you know, Don, the question becomes if you can't see your fear, it's hard to recognize that that's what's stopping you. People rationalize, you know, I don't want to be successful in business because I believe that the world should have a Buddhist kind of philosophy, you know what I mean?
Yes.
I mean, it sometimes gets hidden behind a belief system.
Yes.
And they kind of hide out. I'm not going to take that jump. I'm not going to compete. I'm a violinist, but I'm not going to audition. I'm an actress or I'm an actor, and I'm not going to compete. These are the signs, I guess. Are these signs of fear? What are the signs of these? How do you know it's
these,
fear?
These are obvious signs, but what I see is a tentativeness, a reluctance, a hesitation. That's an indicator of the fear, again, because fear will restrict. What it does is, on an unconscious level, prevent the person from either moving or taking action, and also from knowing what the fear is, as you say. They may feel it or not, or rationalize it away, but underneath it, there's an unknowing. So what I ask a lot of people to do, whether it's fears of failure, fear of success, or a combination, and oftentimes it is a combination, is to literally ask them to write it out, to get it out of their head swirling around with everything else there, and specifically pinpoint on a piece of paper what their fears are. Write them out. Once they can become conscious of it by seeing them on the paper, they can see, you know, it's not that big a deal, and then start coming up with a strategy to address and confront each one of them. A well-thought-out strategy, again, with the conscious mind, rather than just having this swirl around in one's subconscious or unconscious without really attending to it, then it becomes an underlying free-floating anxiety, which, again, immobilizes the person. So one of the first things I do, whether it's fear of failure, fear of success, or other fears, is literally have people write them out or verbalize them so they can get it into the light of day. And once they do that, they see that these monsters really aren't that bad.
Well, let's go to an example, right? Now, you were a diver, weren't you?
Yes.
I mean, like a swimming diver.
I was a springboard diver, yes.
Springboard diver, good. Okay, let's use that as an example, right? Now, there's somebody you would work with. You get somebody who's a springboard diver, and they're up there on the high dive board, and they know that there's one way they could approach this dive, which is full out, and then there's another way which is hesitant.
Yes.
Right, but they are either going to be in the competition. They're going to do a triple Lux with a viral twist, you know, whatever you call those things when you do the diving. But they're going to do it, and they want to do it. Now, what are the different scenarios? What happens to the people who succeed versus the people who don't succeed?
Well,
what's the difference?
One thing we can look at: generally, divers when they're doing a forward dive or a gainer will take 3 or 4 steps and then do a hurdle and come down on the end of the board. The last step of their hurdle, where they push off and raise their knee up, is a critical point. And if a diver is afraid or unsure or hesitant, they will do what's called babying their last step and not push off. Their fear may be that if they push off too much, they'll come to the end of the board and be leaning forward, that they've accelerated too much. The worst thing that will happen then is they'll shoot out too far into the middle of the pool. They may not do a good dive, but they're not going to hit the board. It's the divers who are tentative, who are cautious, who are trying to play it safe, and don't aggressively go at that last step, that baby the last step doesn't bring them to the end of the board. Not only will they not get enough spring to do the dive, but they'll be back on the board and stand a real good chance of hitting the board. So what I see over and over again is what people fear produces tentativeness. The most risky situation is not taking risks, is being cautious. As I like to say, sailing ships are safe in harbors. Sailing ships are not meant to stay in harbors. You can't steal second base with your foot on first. Mm-hmm. In almost every arena, in sports and music, certainly competitive diving, working with business people, at the moment of truth when they need to go for it, the tentativeness caused by fear or cautiousness caused by fear prevents a more dangerous situation than if they go for it.
One would think you're listening to a Green Beret telling you the only way to do it is go for it. But we're going to get a little deeper than this, my friends, because this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We don't just take the surface. We're with Dr. Don Green, who has written a book called Fight Your Fear and Win. And before it's going to get really interesting later, but right now it's going to get interesting too, because we're going to talk about the seven
skills for performing one's best.
All right, now
pressure.
This is whether you are somebody who wants to audition. You work with Juilliard, don't you?
Yes.
Okay, you audition if you're an artist who wants to audition, a painter who wants to paint, present your painting, if you're a runner who wants to run, if there's something in your life you want to go for, these are going to be very interesting to look at. So let's look at the seven skills, right, for overcoming your fears.
Well, let's start first by saying if you want to go for something, namely achieve something, and that's generally what performers and athletes have in common. They want to achieve a personal best or a gold medal or some type of tangible outside reward. When you think of that, then you, what comes next is doing it under pressure, because the pressure of competition, the pressure of just one competing with oneself. So these seven skills are related to what it takes to perform your best under that pressure in any area.
All right. Now, before we go further, I'm going to introduce here, we're going to hear the seven skills for helping you perform better in all of your life. As a side note, I asked Don a little earlier, hey, what about in relationships? Would these seven skills apply? Well, we're not going to talk about the seven skills in relationships, but I want you out there who are listening to think about how you can take these individual skills and apply them to your personal lives in your loving relationships. All right? I mean, just as a side note, so that you could have both of these working, because I think we have something here, my friends. Let's go for it, Don. I know this is not what you do, right?
No, this is not what I do.
You don't expect to be talking about love, romance, and sex, and how you can improve all with the seven skills. Okay, so here we are, love, romance, and sex, the seven skills plus how to get in bed in business. Let's go for it.
Okay, the first skill.
Let's name what they are first.
Well, the first one is determination, and this is simply one's motivation, one's inner drive, one's will to succeed. Because without that, it's not going to go very far. Motivation, one's inner drive, is very important. If you're motivated to achieve the goal, you'll have a much better chance than if you're not the least bit interested in doing it. So,
well, just for a second, does that apply to romance, love, sex, romance, right? Determination, do you think it has anything to do with it? Maybe. Put that on the side, because we're really going to talk about just success today, okay? The name of the book, my friend, is Fight Your Fear and Win. Second thing about how to get better sex, better love, and better romance, the second skill is?
Well, energy, and this may very well pertain.
It sure sounds like it. Go ahead.
In this context, since it's dealing with fear, a lot of times it's too much energy, that the person feels the adrenaline, and once that kicks in, it does things that they don't necessarily like or are comfortable with, and it affects their performance. In the context we're talking about, the energy can be either too high or sometimes too low. And I find with people that audition time and time again, after a while, if they're not doing well and affects their attitude, sometimes they go in with low energy. So it's the ability not just to bring energy down or control the stress response or control nerves, but also at points to raise the energy, because audition panels look for exciting performances, not boring ones. So the energy has to do with the ability to control one's mental and physical energies, because that pertains to performance. Any performance is a result of mental and physical energy. So when we talk about energy, it's from the point of sports psychology and controlling the energy to get to the energy level where people perform the best.
People usually feel like they're a slave to their energy. You know that most people say, I'm too nervous, I'm this, I'm that, and they can't do anything about it. I'm depressed. And they don't see themselves as being able to do anything. And I can understand in business or in trying to achieve a goal, in auditions, in the world of art, how this energy level, if you feel like you're a slave to that inner buzz and the energy level, is going to inhibit your success.
Exactly right. And more than that, it's knowing that you don't have control over this. So I find with my performing artists, when they go to auditions and they feel the adrenaline kick in, it's not just the adrenaline. It's knowing that, oh, my God, there it goes again, and knowing that they have no control over it. And if sports psychology can teach us anything, it's that we have control over these energy levels. If it's too high, we can bring it down. If it's too low, we can raise it. Most performers, most athletes, most people know the energy level where they perform their best. Maybe it's up a little bit or just a little bit of calm, but it's neither frantic nor asleep. It's someplace in between those. And if people can figure out where they perform their best, at what energy level where they have performed their best, then it's just a simply a matter of teaching them methods like centering that can help them either lower their energy when they need it in less than 10 seconds or raise their energy up if they're feeling low so that they can get to the level where they know they perform their best. And the knowledge that they have a technique or a way to do that a lot of times gets rid of some of the frantic nerves.
And we're going to go into all these techniques on all these skills. Think about it with radio programming. You know, I have seen a lot of people who have come by who were wonderful people, calm people, psychologists who, or Buddhists or people who are monks, and they'd come by and they should have a radio show of their own. But if you're on radio, energy level is very important. If a person has an energy that is not, if it doesn't come out, if it doesn't add energy, But if it's passive energy, nobody listens. People listen to the radio to be energized on many levels, and sometimes the energy makes them calm. But there is a level where that energy is frantic. And when that energy gets frantic or aggressive and you hear that, the audience turns off. So actually, the art of doing radio, as one of the arts of, that you're talking about, requires maintaining a certain energy level.
Exactly.
And watching your energy level, making sure how it's affecting. Now, how would that be affecting relationships? Do you think that maintaining your energy level affects, or looking at your energy level affects your romantic life? Of course it does. You go home like you're a dish rag being dragged out. How do you expect to get a response? You go home hyper. How do you expect to get a response? Right? You go meet somebody you love, and this energy is just out of control, and you're at the mercy of it. Of course it's going to have a strong effect on your romantic, your love life, your sex life. But that's not what we're writing about, right? Okay, that's Don, let's see. We're going to get one that doesn't work for sure. Because this is your second book, you know. You could just take the cover off, put the cover on of, you know, success, fighting your fear of loving and winning. Okay.
If you'd like.
The third skill.
Third skill is perspective, and I think we'll have a close one here. Perspective has to do with somebody's state of mind going into a performance situation, going into a high-stress negotiation, going into maybe a confrontation with their spouse or the significant other. And it has to do with what they think is going to happen, how they play it out in their mind. Are they listening to the same old tapes in their mind of this isn't going to work, no, that's not going to go well, can't you get it right, the self-critical tapes, which can obscure a person's going in with an open mind, say, to a discussion with a spouse. The other thing has to do with expectancy. What are their pictures in their mind of how it's going? Are they replaying in their mind doomsday videos of the last time they had a talk like this and it turned out to be a disaster? Are they replaying doomsday videos? Or hopefully seeing it turn out well, envisioning different contingencies of how it could go well, and then following those when you go into the situation of the discussion.
We're going to go into each one of these in depth. You know, certainly perspective and romance makes a difference, huh? How you're going in there, what you expect, the picture you have. But each one of these today, as we get this hour and maybe a future hour after this, let's talk about the next one, the fourth skill that people have to look at to evaluate their...
Okay, the fourth skill is courage. It's what we talked about before as the antidote for the different fears we talked about. I look at several different types of fears. We've talked about some of them. One is fear of success, as we've discussed, fear of failure. But I also look at another fear I call the bigger fear. And I find this holding a lot of creative people back, a lot of performers, a lot of artists, a lot of composers and writers. And this bigger fear is, what if I really, really, really gave it my best, put everything I had into it, and it still didn't work? I'd be devastated. How would I deal with that? And the fear of that, to me, is what holds a lot of creative people back, when it need not, that everybody who is willing to address that one is willing to get past it, and there's no reason to be afraid of that one. They'll be able to deal with it. Oftentimes, they're very happy with that, with the result of really, really going after it. They're very pleased with the result.
Well, the problem here is, of course, you say courage. There is a certain amount of whatever the word courage really means. I mean, what does courage mean? Does courage mean you feel the reluctance and you go ahead anyway? What does it mean?
Well, this is a great question. Courage is not the absence of fear. Fear is going to be present in most of the things that we do in our life. It's not wishing it away, hoping it away. That doesn't work. If it's going to be of consequence, there'll be fear there. It's not the absence of fear. It's addressing the fear consciously and then doing the thing we fear. The more we do that, the more we get in the habit of addressing the fear, and we see that the biggest fear of all is in not dealing with these fears. It will restrict our lives. And we see that a good acronym for fear that I like is false evidence appearing real. A lot of what we fear, we make up in our heads. We project the things out. 99.9% of what we worry about never happens. But we go through these fear scenarios in our head to create these things. And generally what we spend a lot of time thinking about, picturing, fearing, we actually bring into our lives. If we dwell on it enough, we're going to cause that to happen. If one of my singers worries enough about missing the high note and dwells for the last 3 days before going into the performance or audition, fearing, worrying about missing that high note, she'll probably miss that high note.
Right. I understand. So focus. Next is focus, the next skill.
Next is focus. This is one of the most obscure ones, if you will, of the seven skills. As much as we like to teach people or say to people that they should concentrate or yell at them after they don't concentrate, we don't teach what concentration is. We don't teach our athletes or performers or anybody in life really how to focus. A lot of it comes out of the martial arts, the Eastern philosophies, certainly not our culture, where we are praised for how fast we think in our left brain, how quick we can analyze a solution, how quick we can come up with the mathematical solution to this problem. We are rewarded for how fast our left brain thinks, but very little is done to reinforce the more focused right brain, where we see pictures clearly, where we think in terms of feelings and sounds, not in terms of words and numbers. It's in this right brain where we really achieve the mental quiet that's necessary for focus. But so much of our culture, so much of our society is against this, that we're paid to think faster, think more critically, more judgmentally. And these actually limit the process of focus, the ability to focus, to keep one's quiet mind focused on one thing exclusively until that thing is done. This is not something in society that we teach people how to do.
Now, in school, when you're a kid, I mean, of course, the way they do it is they let you look at something and they intimidate you in school to pay, and I always love this word, pay attention.
Yes.
Which means take attention, T-E-N-S-I-O-N, create attention in your body, now pay that tension. Because by paying that attention, you're going to learn something. Focus on that book in front of you. Study those books while you're dying to do everything else. But they never teach a child how to focus. A friend of mine, Marge King in California, was part of a study group where they had a thing called the galvanic skin response machine, a GSR machine that would emit a tone. You'd put two fingers on it, and it would emit a tone. She brought this to children. Now, if you meditated, focused your mind, the tone would get lower, like a grovel. And if you were nervous, it would go all the way up. She had these children competing on who could make the lower sound. So now they were competing in meditation. It was such a brilliant thing. And these were urban kids too. So now all these kids are kind of looking at this machine, and they're making it. They're going to focus their minds to make the sound deeper, and they're moving into these meditative states. These kids skipped grades after grades after grades, having the skill to learn how to focus.
Yes,
by using a little tool like a galvanic skin response machine.
Yes, that's fantastic.
Yeah, we're looking at the different skills that you have to examine and see if you want to develop your or progress yourself in the areas where you sometimes hold back. Now comes my favorite. Of the seven skills, we've already talked about determination, energy, perspective, courage, focus. Let's talk about focus in relationships just as a side in case it applies. If you're dating 20 people, you may not get the kind of attention you're going to get if you're dating one. Right? If you put your focus on one place, if you have that focus in one place or two, you're going to get a lot more energy than if you put it in 10 or 20. That's kind of obvious, right? Are you going to put your time there, or are you going to worry about the house? Are you going to worry about building the house, or are you going to worry about your love? Where are you going to put your attention? If you don't focus your attention on your romance itself, on your relationship, if you don't give that the priority by relaxing into it, not paying attention, but by clearing your mind and letting yourself sink into that relationship, that's where the focus pays off. Wonderful book by Gene Gendlin. Do you ever hear of Gene Gendlin?
No.
Psychologist, wrote a book called Focusing and Listening. Wonderful skills and techniques, which I know you have some in this book as well. Let's talk about the next one now. The next skill.
Could I just go back to one?
Sure.
Talking about relationships?
Yeah.
I agree with everything you said. One of the focusing skills is presence, the ability to be fully present.
You got to bring somebody a lot of presents.
Yes. Well, to me, the best present a spouse or significant other could give to their significant other is when they're with them to really be with them, not sure. thinking about problems at work that they're trying to solve, but to, like you said before, focus and listen, to be really present and pay attention to the person and listen to them. To me, that would solve a lot of relationship difficulties.
I received a letter just today from a man who, and you know, I think we're going to read that letter on the air. Talk about focusing. Talk about what it's like to focus your attention, relax. And he talked about how he every time his child would come to him, this is a very brave man, he said he's been learning about himself. He said, and whenever his daughter would come to him and say, I'm afraid of something, he would kind of give her advice. He would say, well, tell your teacher. If you're afraid of missing the bus, tell your teacher, right? And then that would be, and he realized that they didn't want the advice. He realized that he wanted his daughter wanted him to hear her. So what he said was, I'm with you. It's okay to be afraid. I understand. Then he talked about his son coming to him and saying, well, I'm not so afraid. And looking at another piece of advice he could have dropped or another word he could have advised. Instead, he just kind of looked at his son and gave him some attention, gave him that thing the son needed.
Wonderful.
And he found what a wonderful difference that is. Being able to be there for someone.
Presence.
Amazing. Being able to be there for yourself.
Yes.
Presence. And being able to approach any task with presence. You ever try to do your taxes when you're running all over the place?
Every direction but there.
You get in the room, you sit down, you got your sharpened pencils, you go to work. You know what I mean? Give it your attention. Relax. Dedicate your time. The next 5 hours doing my tax return, and you'll do it in 5 hours.
If you can be fully there, you'll do it.
You'll do it, right. All right, now let's look at the next, which is beautiful.
Well, the next is poise, and this is one of the most significant skills. This is the ability to do several different things under pressure. What we're looking at here is first decision-making, the ability to make good, sound, clear decisions decisively under pressure. Versus, again, going with a left brain, scattered, very noisy approach to a problem. So, again, the ability to shift from left brain to right brain to achieve mental quiet before making decisions is a key part in decision-making strategy.
So what is poise?
Poise is having the ability to think clearly, to present well, make good presentations, to negotiate well, and to multitask well. Different related skills, they all involve the ability to shift from left brain to right brain to make the decision before making the presentation, before going into negotiation or during negotiation, and certainly while multitasking, while trying to handle a number of things in rapid sequence. All of those abilities are under poise, and the ability to do those well is affected by pressure. It need not. People can learn how to not only do these under pressure adequately, but actually to thrive under pressure situations and learn how to use the energy of adrenaline or the pressure situations, what it does to a person, use that energy to do better, to make better decisions, to come up with more creative solutions, to present with more energy, or to multitask more effectively with more focus, with more presence, using the energy that adrenaline gives.
We're going to be right back, and we're going to talk about that because I want to talk about multitasking as soon as we get back. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. It's 1:30 here on WBAI or thereabouts, 99.5 FM. Here's a little something to attend to, my friends. Let yourself relax a little. Let yourself think about these different challenges you've had in your life and the times you've backed off. And give yourself, you know, it's okay. You backed off at those times, but what is it you'd like to be doing for yourself? What is it you'd like to give your whole hog? Where would you like to throw that challenge in there? Maybe take on the thing you've always wanted to take on. We'll be back with Don Green in just a little bit. kind of reminds you, doesn't it, friends? That's from Midnight Express, the theme song. Always kind of touched me deeply. But makes you think about your life, you know? It makes you think about the many times and the many opportunities you've had to make a real difference for yourself, you know? And something inside you holds you back over and over again. That's okay. That's okay. We're not meant to be stars. Sometimes we got to look at these things and maybe confront them. If you want to take the next step, it becomes a choice. Well, maybe today we'll look at it differently. Talk about not being able to overcome an obstacle, huh, Don? Midnight Express? Look, Don, we're going to go over the rest of this. But so far, you're saying you got to fear, you got to deal with it, suck in your belly, hold your breath, deal with it one way or another so far. But multitasking, I mean, when we're talking about somebody who's been battered as a child, who's been battered into submission, who's been battered into believing that they are nothing. When you have a father who says to his child, you're a boy, you'll always be a boy, you'll never be a man, right? As a way of criticizing that you'll never be good at anything, and they drum these messages into a child's head as a way of punishing the child. How is a child going to deal with that? What is it, meditate? What's the idea here? What are you going to do? And I think this is where we run into multitasking. Right.
Well, it does come into play in multitasking. When we look at multitasking, we're looking at a very, very rapid sequence of events where somebody needs their full attention paid to whatever they're paying attention to. And what I found generally in most pressure situations, there's two general things holding people back. One is the negative tapes playing of rather than paying attention to what they should be focusing on, they're hearing criticism, whether it's criticism from one of their parents, criticism from their band teacher in high school or their English teacher, that instead of focusing, they're hearing these tapes playing. The other thing is that these tapes are often tied to fears. So the fear kicks in, and then they think about the worst consequences, what will happen, the reprimands, and then the critical voices come in. So the very reason they're not focused or paying full attention when they're multitasking is because of either the fear or the negative voices, the criticism, or both. So we deal with them differently. Fear is an emotion, and it needs to be dealt with differently than the thoughts, the critical thoughts of, no, you're not doing this well, what's wrong with you, can't you do this? So we deal with them differently. The emotion of fear takes action. People need to remember the things they did courageously in their lives, because my experience has shown me that people, regardless of their walk of life or what position in life they've attained, all of them have attained successful results by dealing with fear, by taking courageous actions. And anybody can go back in their memory, and hopefully will, to not just the things they did that were fearful, but more importantly, the courageous things they have done.
So a person standing in the wings, about to get their solo performance out on stage, right?
Yes.
And they suddenly feel themselves with stage fright, and they're shaking like a leaf, right? Now, they can't get out there. You're not saying ignore those voices that are telling you be frightened, you know, all this stuff. You're saying by preparing yourself, the way to prepare yourself is to deal with the voices.
Well, again, with the voices, we're dealing with thought. And it's different dealing with thought than dealing with the fear. People are under the stressful situation are going to feel a stress response. They're going to feel their hands clammy. They're going to feel their heart pounding. They're going to feel the adrenaline surging through them. They can feel that. Nothing they say to themselves is going to immediately negate that or get rid of that. But it's on the thought channel, it's the person's interpretation of that. And what I find is untrained people, a lot of people, make the wrong interpretation. And the wrong interpretation for that person in the wings is, oh my God, why did that have to happen now? Now I'm not going to do well. That's the wrong interpretation. Whereas athletes learn earlier than most performers to interpret it correctly, namely, this is normal. I'm getting ready to go on. I feel nervous. I should be nervous. This is very important. I'm about to go on stage, and interpret it correctly, namely, I've done this before. I can use this energy for more excitement, more focus. So on the level of emotion of fear, It's reminding themselves of the times they have done it before and how it went successfully. And rather than picturing doomsday videos of scenarios of them failing, they remember in their mind's eye those images when they did well over and over, and this one and that one. That's on the emotional level. On the level of thought, it's writing those negative critical voices out and then literally confronting them.
Let's talk about that. Let's slow it down a second, okay? Writing out those critical voices. So you had a parent who may have, or siblings, or people who laughed at you, and they said, you're ugly, you're fat, you're skinny, you don't look good, you can't do this. And there are those voices. It is not ignore the voices, which is what the behaviorists say. You're saying write them down. Now, this is a very interesting thing because here you are, a sports psychologist who should be saying, just get beyond it. By what we know most sports psychologists do, you're saying, let's deal with these. Let's deal with the emotionality of this. What do you write down?
Well, you write down literally what those voices are saying in the very words without censoring.
So, for example, give me an example of what the voices could be saying.
You suck. Can't you do any better than that? Now, the first thing I want them to do after they write it down is identify the source of that. What's the origination point of that? Who said that first?
You know, it's an interesting thing that you choose. As a... You were talking about what's called the negative parental interject, which is, in psychology, it means you hear a voice and you identify it, but you say exactly right. You know, Donna, because it's brilliant. You have to write it down exactly the way you hear it. Don't reinterpret it, because you're going to see a word like, you're too stupid to do that. And when you write it down and you look on a piece of paper, you're going to say to yourself, who would have used words like, you're too stupid to do that? And you'll find older sister, older brother, the very words that they used. Whereas if you reinterpret it and you say, well, not smart enough, you might not have heard them say that. So you've got to get their exact words and write it down. Take the words you hear in your mind and make a list of them. And then you will associate those words with the people who first made the tape in your mind.
Yes. So either give them that name, or sometimes you can't trace it and remember it. And I ask my clients to give them humorous names. Nasty Nelly, The Scrooge, Sarcastic Fred, whatever it is. Then you can start objectively dealing with these. And the questions I ask people look at after they're written out, is this still accurate and true? Or is this something left over from 20 years ago? With my Juilliard musicians, I often find them saying things like, can't you play in tune? When they solved that problem when they were in high school, that they always play in tune. It's no longer pertinent. It's no longer accurate. So one of them is to look at it and see if it's accurate. Second one, is it helping? Is it solution-oriented or just berating the person? A lot of good musicians, a lot of good performers got to be good by holding high standards for themselves and demanding they do the best, and if they didn't, to really be critical. That got them to Juilliard or got them in the Met Orchestra, but it's certainly not a way to help them perform at their best or to focus. So I asked them to confront them, see if it's accurate, and then start challenging them, almost as if they were their own defense counsel. Say, wait a minute, Your Honor, I object. That's no longer true. Maybe I did play out of tune 10 years ago, but I'm constantly playing in tune or in time right now. So after they identify it and start challenging them, then they can start dealing with them. And the more they challenge them, the less they hear them. And I ask them to keep on writing them out until they don't hear them anymore. The last one is generally when we hear these voices, especially in pressure situations, we lose one of our best friends, and that's our sense of humor. It gets to be life and death. You see people under stress. They are not smiling. They are not laughing. This is very, very serious, too serious, because, again, the voices are driving them into believing that this is life and death.
Mm-hmm.
And they will continually to berate or, if you will, rag on the person over and over and over again. And for those people, I have the three magic words. And the three magic words, if in the middle of getting berated by their own critical committee, if you will, not just one person, but the whole panel is there chewing them out, if in the middle of that they can have the presence of mind to say the three magic words, it will bring a smile to their face and it will change the situation forever. The three magic words are, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you hear the voice working at you saying you can't do it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You think about that in love too, boy. You know, how many times we have had to try to deal with these voices from the past telling you you're not good enough, you don't deserve it. Write them down. Identify them. You need more than just courage. You need more than just somebody who challenges them and says, you're wrong, I'm not this. You need a friend along who also says, it's okay. That was then. This is now.
Yes.
And that friend is what's, I think, going to make the real difference. When you become a friend to yourself, when you're nurturing yourself like a good coach would. There's a great movie. Did you see The Legend of Bagger Vance?
Yes.
Right?
Excellent.
Was that Bagger Vance? Is that
Bagger
right?
Vance.
Bagger Vance. Excellent because you had that kind of friend.
Exactly.
You didn't have somebody saying you shouldn't be afraid. He was like this little Buddhist who comes along to help somebody with their golf game. You know, it comes out of nowhere. Will Smith. Beautiful, beautiful presentation. But it's the idea is to kind of get you to befriend yourself as you're striving and befriend all your fears and to say, yeah, yeah, they're there, not to deny them.
Well, one of the things that a lot of people do under pressure is say things to themselves that they would never say to a friend or somebody they were trying to help out. In fact, a lot of my performing artists say they wouldn't hang out with somebody who would say to them what they do say to themselves as they are in the wings, as they're about to go on. So a lot of this has to do with changing those habit patterns of thinking to more supportive, more encouraging ones, or mental quiet. They don't need the instructions. They don't need the reinforcement. What they need is, again, a supportive voice, somebody encouraging them, somebody telling them that they can do it. And you don't need to have somebody outside doing this. You can do this from inside. You can change those negative, critical voices, as we've talked about, by writing them out, challenging them, giving them names, switch them over to more positive, supportive statements, or nothing at all, mental quiet.
Resilience. And number seven here, the seventh skill. What is resilience playing?
Well, resilience is a big one. It's why it's number seven. It's the ability to bounce back after a mistake, after a setback. Because all of the arenas we're talking about, sports, music, life, it's not just one performance. There's many performances.
How about romance?
Performance every day.
You need romantic resilience, boy. You got to have it. If you quit after that one shot, I met somebody recently who said she hasn't had a relationship in 10 years. And she said, the last one hurt too much. I don't want to go there again. It's getting the resilience, getting being able to do it. How do you do it? I mean, sometimes, you know, you give a try. You give everything you've got, Don. Everything. You put it all out there. You've met people who put it all out there.
Absolutely.
Putting it all out there doesn't mean you're going to succeed.
That's right.
I mean, it doesn't mean, I don't know, it doesn't mean you're going to fail. It doesn't mean you're going to get the top banana. You know, you're not going to get the number one spot. So you came in 47th. You know, so you ran the marathon and you put everything you had into it, but you forgot that there was that guy who's got rubber band legs, you know, who was going to run ahead of you, and he kind of made it look simple. How do you deal with those disappointments? How do you deal with that?
Well, again, it's how we interpret the disappointment. We have control over some things, like our own performance, but we don't necessarily have control over somebody else having a better peak performance on a given day than we do. So I ask my athletes and performers to look at whether they did their best and not judge it by external standards as much as was it better than last time. But it's not always going to be better than last time. Then what they need to do is figure out what they did wrong, figure out what they did right, what they can do better the next time, and then after a rest, because a lot of people go back into it too soon without summoning up the energy needed after a setback to do it properly. So I recommend after a setback, including after situations of after winning, because winning can be as stressful as losing, that people rest, summon up the energy, and then set goals again, determination, if you will, get their motivation back up and focus on the next target and doing better with the next pursuit.
Let's just change that a little. Not change it, but I appreciate that. I'm going to go over the seven skills: determination, energy, perspective, courage, focus, poise, resilience, right? All of these important things. Fight your fear and win. Don Green, Dr. Don Green, is sports psychologist. But Don, you got to. I can't help but look at the fact that you are ex-Green Beret, military man, you know, guy who went into SWAT teams. I mean, you sound like what they call a counterphobic guy. You know, you go in there, somebody comes along and says, you're scared, jump in. You know, and yet you don't speak the words of counterphobia, you know. You're saying, yeah, you got to give the emotions of what they deserve. Give them their play. Where do you come from? I mean, did you have a military family? Did you have Where does all this dealing with fear come from?
Well, I grew up on Long Island. My father was in the Army Air Corps, but I'm not sure I got it that way, or was a springboard diver. Because all through high school and college until after I got out of college, I had a huge fear of public speaking. I couldn't do it. Every time a presentation was coming up, I'd not sleep for days, live in fear of it, get up there and choke big time.
Well, that
blank out, forget it, not be able to do well, and just die.
But
all through high school and college.
That often comes from having a background with a kind of a taskmaster parent, you know, a parent who says, you know, who you kind of admire, and you admire, and you're afraid you just can't come up to par with that kind of a parent. You got a dad here who's, you know, military kind of guy and a strong kind of guy. It must have been scary.
My father was a loving man.
Loved you.
Yes.
And in all his loving, there was this, you didn't feel like you couldn't, like you didn't want to own up to him, like you didn't want to make it to happen for him. Because I'm wondering if you know from the inside what a lot of people have to deal with, that fear very often has to do with trying to prove yourself to a parent, an underlying thing. And therefore, you have stage fright because you're so afraid of whether or not you could bring it across for your parent.
I don't see it that way because I would go to diving meets. My parents would come to diving meets, and I'd do the dives and sometimes do well and sometimes not. But I was more afraid of hitting the diving board than my parents' reaction. Mm-hmm. But in terms of making presentations, they weren't really involved. This was something that happened at school. I'm not sure they were even aware of it. But I knew it was going on, and I had to deal with it. Not very well, but I tried.
What do you mean, not really well?
Well, like I said, all through high school and college, I lived and died with presentations I'd have to make, and I didn't do well. I was very embarrassed. I'd come off just glad that I lived through it, but I certly didn't get good grades for my presentation. I was very interested in going to law school. But I just couldn't see myself in front of a jury making a presentation. The thought of it scared me to death.
Wow.
So I didn't go into law school.
But it's really beautiful because here you are doing a radio program. And, I mean, just so much ease and so much ease in what you're doing. You're doing this so beautifully, you know.
Thank you.
One of the best guests I ever had on the air because you're talking so well. Somebody who was so afraid to talk in public, you know. You kind of took this in giant vault. What do you think made the difference in your life?
Well, what made the difference was I got my degree in sports psychology, and I found this technique called centering that I teach in my book that can help performers or people just about to go on stage or a mother going to address the PTA, that it's a system that helps control the energy, and knowing that you have the system certainly helps a lot.
So when did you get this centering?
I got this when I was going through my doctorate. In the early 80s, the man who invented centering, Bob Nideffer, a prominent sports psychologist, had gone to Japan and studied the martial art of Aikido. He came back with his black belt in Aikido, got his doctorate in psychology, and then combined the Aikido martial art with the ideas of Western psychology and came up with a 7-step process to teach people how to quickly control their energy and focus in less than 10 seconds before an important situation.
So there you are, a frightened guy who can't really do the presentations, and you hear this information, and you try it on. You say, well, let me try on this focusing, right?
Yes.
And let me do this centering. And you did it.
I did it, and I found myself in more control of being more present and actually being able to talk rather than just stutter, if you will, and be able to get my ideas across because the centering helped me both control the stress response and then also learn to switch to right brain, past the chatterbox, past the left brain noise we've been talking about, and really focus on presenting, focus on the task at hand.
What was your first successful presentation, do you remember?
My first successful one had to do with these police SWAT officers that I had to present to.
Uh-huh.
I worked with the San Diego Police SWAT team, and I was teaching them how to center. And after learning it myself and really using it, I went before this tough group of SWAT officers to teach them this very system so they could use it in stress shooting. And I found it to be very effective in terms of controlling me and making me more effective in those situations that I used to freak out about.
Amazing. Amazing. It must have been quite a mind-boggling thing for you.
It really changed my life.
You know? And glad you were able to write about it. It is Dr. Don Green. This is Armand DeMille. You know, what about your fears, my friends? What about your fears? Do you think that there's stuff that you just can't overcome? You know, there, no matter how old you get, there's always a new mountain that you can climb if you decide to do it. So I remember a friend who was describing a young boy who was out in the street the other day, like a toddler, was out in the street, and he approached his first speed bump. We talked about how looking at this toddler who was walking over its first speed bump, saw a speed bump, and now is walking on level ground for about 20 steps, the first 20 steps it ever walked on level ground, sees a speed bump and learns how to walk up the speed bump and over the speed bump, that something happens, that Ben actually now is changing his elevation and now unchanging his elevation. Well, the minute he learned how to do the speed bump, he found it great fun. And his grandmother, who took him through this, who described it to me, said he went back to walk over the speed bump again. He found this more fun than walking level. And then he went back to do it again. And he said everybody was watching Ben learn about a speed bump. Well, that's all of us, you know? That's all of us. If we could learn about our own speed bumps, if there's something in us that would make us, that would help us get through, you know, our own speed bumps in life, because that's all they are. A friend of mine, Rainer Heilriegel, a psychologist, used to say, we're trying to teach people that there are mice and there are elephants, and sometimes they see mice and they think they're elephants. The name of the book is Fight Your Fear and Win, a 21-day plan. Don Green, PhD, with us here today. And Don, I want to thank you for being with us. Thanks for this information. Maybe we'll get together and do more of this, because I do want to talk about how you can improve your sex life using the skills that are outlined in this book. I'm sure you can. Your love life, romance, it's all the same, isn't it, friends? Send me an email. Let me know how you like the program. Armand@brainlink.com. Back with you, my friends, at 1 p.m. Bye-bye for now. Like a sleeping child. If the memory of the light should fade, horizons reaching cold. For me.